It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back in on Monday. You are with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. Today we'll look at the Midwest camping tradition known as the Pudgy Pie. First, like many of us, our federal lawmakers are off of work today. They've been in recess since last Friday. In fact, Congress members have a full, roughly 265 days during which they're not required to be in Washington. That amount of time off in general is sometimes contentious, but what gets more contentious is what lawmakers do with their time. For example, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's recent unexpected loss in his Republican primary is largely attributed to a loss of touch with his home district. On one hand, constituents want the lawmakers at home in touch with local issues. On the other, they want representatives in Washington getting stuff done. The balance can be tricky. Gannett Washington Bureau reporter Donovan Slack recently reported on where Wisconsin's representatives fall when it comes to the time they spend in Wisconsin versus how much time they spend in Washington. Donovan joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So when weighing this debate, more time in the district versus more time in Washington, they really can't win in a way. Let's hear the argument on both sides. What's the argument to spend more time here in Wisconsin or wherever that district might be?
Well, you know, spending more time at home, people argue, gives them more interaction with constituents. They get to hear more what their constituents feel and think and what they want them to do. And the hit on not spending enough time there is that they lose touch with what their constituents want, and therefore they aren't adequately able to represent those views in Washington.
But on the other hand, if they're spending all their time in their district, are they doing what they need to do to get the job done in Washington? That's the counterargument, I guess.
Exactly. There's a lot of people here in Washington who say they need to spend more time here so that they can build relationships and maybe overcome the gridlock. And there's also something to be said for learning more about the institution, how it works, how the committees work. If you're at home in Wisconsin, you're not going to spend a lot of time doing that.
Is there a growing trend toward valuing that district time more and having more contempt, at least in some parts of the public, for too much time in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, just look at the polls. Congress is at an approval rating of an all-time low. I think it was 7% last I saw. And if you spend too much time here in Washington, you become a member of this institution that people hate and less a resident of Wisconsin.
Well, you focused some on Wisconsin's delegation in a recent piece. Let's look at some of them. Representative Tom Petri, you talked about him illustrating the routines of a lawmaker who spends maybe more time in Washington. How does he split that up?
Well, yeah, he actually only spends about 36% of his time off in Wisconsin. And this could have been a major vulnerability for him if he decided to seek reelection. You know, he spends most of his time here in Washington, 70% or so, and that has already led critics to say, you know, he's gone Washington.
You know, before we get back to Wisconsin's delegation more, is there something about how close you live to Washington? If you're in Maryland, Virginia, it's easy to commute. If you're the further west you get, the harder it is to come back and forth to the district and to D.C.?
Well, absolutely, that argument could be made. I mean, look at these poor Congress people from Hawaii. That's an hour flight. But when you talk about Wisconsin, it's a one-hour, you know, hour-and-a-half flight. So there really isn't that argument.
How did the rest of our delegation look when it came to splitting time, their time not in session? Are they at home in D.C.? What's the ratio?
Well, it's really interesting, but most of the newer elected members, those that were elected in the past 5 years, spent at least 180 days in Wisconsin, and that's out of 265 days they have off. So that's a good chunk of time. And you're looking at Representative Sean Duffy of Wausau. He spent 86% of his time off in Wisconsin. Mark Pocan, 71%. He's from Madison there. Reed Ribble from Green Bay, 70%. And then, of course, people like Petri or Representative James Sensenbrenner from Menominee, who have been in Congress for 35 years, spend most of their time here in Washington.
And how about our senators? apart from the congressional delegation, how do our two senators fit in?
Well, they're right about in the sweet spot in the middle. Tammy Baldwin spends 73% of her time off in Wisconsin, and Ron Johnson spends 70%. And that's pretty average.
Now, this is an issue. It sounds maybe just like some time management here, but this is an issue that can lose people elections, in part maybe people named Eric Cantor. Did this issue factor into his loss in a Republican primary?
Well, absolutely. That was the big reason everybody gave for Eric Cantor's loss of his primary bid, was that he didn't spend enough time in his Virginia district. And this is why this is an important question. I mean, there's really twofold reasons why this happens. If an opponent can argue that you have so-called gone Washington by spending too much time here, that's a real vulnerability at the ballot box. And I think that it's become a much more so of a vulnerability in an age of Tea Party activism. This is one of their prime tactics that they use. They used it against Cantor, and I expect them to use it more in the future, including in Wisconsin.
The fear is that, you know, my lawmaker is going to lose touch with their roots, with what we the people want in their district if they spend too much time in Washington. Is there any, I don't know how you'd measure this, is there any data that shows whether or not lawmakers behave differently if they're in Washington more?
There's not real data on that. I mean, it's hard to draw a line between how they act or how they perform in Congress versus, you know, and then correlate that somehow with the time they spend at home or here. What I can tell you is there's no public data at all showing their trips home except for Senate and House spending records, and those can be very tedious to go through. And that is what I did with this. I felt like it was worth it to get the real data.
Interesting. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a real exciting task.
No, but I think it's worth it. I mean, there's a lot of accusations that fly around, particularly in this day and age, of people don't spend enough time at home. So I thought, well, let's take a real close look and spend some time and figure out how much they actually do spend in Wisconsin.
Do you get a sense of maybe frustration from people in Congress that there's some value in both sides, obviously, in spending time in Washington, learning the system, getting things done, and there's value in being in the district? Is there frustration that they're being watched for how they handle that balancing act?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, I think it's a tough balance. The sweet spot is right in the middle, I am told, and it's hard to find that sweet spot and maintain it.
You know, Eric Cantor did lose, but he's kind of an exception. We see pretty high incumbency rates for people in Congress over the last 10, 20 years, I think. So is this something that maybe people are people in the public are annoyed with their congressperson, but when all is said and done, it's pretty rare that they're going to punish him or her for that?
Well, you know, it seems to be an increasing phenomenon. I don't know, like you said, how much it's going to matter at the end of the day, but there is a sort of throw-them-all-out mentality that has dominated certainly discussion since 2010, when a major Tea Party wave took over the House.
So federal lawmakers have been on recess for about a week now. When they come back, I gather they're going to have just 28 days or so of congressional business before November elections to get something done, or if anything done. Is there an argument to be made with that little time to say, hey, maybe take this recess time, spend it in Washington, try to get things on the table for this rush period before elections?
You know, you would think so, but this is Congress we're talking about. They don't operate like the rest of us, I have to say. And I have yet to see a lawmaker here in town in D.C. I think they're all at home in their district.
And you hear kind of maybe almost golden age talk from people in Congress, in the House and the Senate, saying, in the old days, yeah, we argued with each other, but we lived in the same place. Our kids went to the same daycares or schools. We had these personal connections with people in the other party, and it made it easier to compromise. Now that we have to spend more time in our district, that's less likely to happen. Is that just sort of a golden age fantasy, or is there really something to that?
I mean, I think there's something to it, but I also think it's a golden age fantasy. The reality is what it is. you know, you can spend all the time in the world saying, oh, gosh, I wish it was like that again. And it's just not.
All right, Donovan, thank you for crunching the numbers and sharing them with us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been speaking with Donovan Slack, Gannett and Washington Bureau reporter, about how much time Wisconsin's Congress members spend in Wisconsin versus Washington. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Recently on the show, we talked to our assistant news director and food enthusiast, Noah Ovshinsky, about campfire cooking. Turns out Noah's not the only one on staff who fancies himself a campfire cook. One of Central Time's own producers, Chris Molina, does a lot of cooking around the campfire as well, but he specializes in one thing. And one thing only, pudgy pies. He was mortified to learn that some people on staff didn't know what pudgy pies were. So he's here to explain what they are, why he thinks they're the perfect camping food. Chris, welcome to this side of the glass.
Hi, Rob. Happy 4th of July to you.
Well, I don't want to mortify you further. When you talked about pudgy pies, I smiled and nodded knowledgeably. I've never had a pudgy pie. I'd never heard of it. What is a pudgy pie?
Well, so when I first, you know, brought this up in a meeting, the reaction I got when I tried to explain it was, well, it's just a grilled cheese. Well, it's more than just a grilled cheese is what I'm here to tell you. It's basically, I mean, it is a toasted sandwich that you basically cook over a campfire. Mm. And to do that, you need a special pudgy pie iron, or I've also heard them referred to as hobo pies. But growing up, they were always pudgy pies. So I don't know if that's a regional thing or what.
At the store, would I actually look for something called a pudgy pie iron?
Yeah, absolutely. And it used to be you'd only be able to find them at a camping store, like an REI or a Fontana or something, but now I've seen them in Target. I know if you go to Fleet Farm, they have them, and they seem to have come down in price a little bit, too. So it's a real cheap and easy way to eat while you're camping.
What does it look like, this iron?
So basically, it's a long, I would say maybe about a foot long. You've got like two little poles and a little kind of like metal iron on it. And it kind of like opens up. It's meant to kind of clasp together. The idea being you open it up and you put your two slices of bread in. So really, you know, one of the beauties of, you know, a pudgy pie is you don't need very many ingredients. And a lot of the times you don't really need to refrigerate anything. You know, so if you've got a cooler, you know, you can just throw some stuff in there. If not, you know, maybe not a big deal. But basically all you really need is your bread, and I usually recommend that people just pick up a loaf of white bread or something, because the iron usually is square. You can also get round ones, too, which I'll talk about in a minute. But with these square pudgy pie makers, it's really easy to fit one of those, you know, nice square pieces of sandwich bread in there versus, you know, some fancier bread, which tends to be maybe a little bit more rectangular.
Yeah, an artisan bread might be oblong, misshapen, not fit in the iron.
Right.
So we're basically talking about two pieces of bread with stuff in the middle, heated on, it looks sort of like I looked at pictures online, a George Foreman grill on a stick, and no plug, obviously.
Yeah, you could definitely say that. So I, you know, tend to go with the square one. I didn't realize the round one was, you know, something that existed until actually pretty recently. That's one where you can't really easily put, you know, a square piece of bread in there. The trick that I've seen people using is they'll actually take, you know, like Pillsbury crescent dough and put that in there, which I've never tried, which sounds sort of fantastic, actually. But yeah, all you need is the bread. Bring some butter or some cooking spray so that you don't burn the pieces of bread onto the iron, and then whatever fillings you want. And that's the great part about pudgy pie, is what I think makes it the perfect camping food, is you can really put anything you want on a pudgy pie, and it works for every meal of the day. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, you name it, you can make a pudgy pie for it.
Well, we'll get into some of your fillings in a minute. Let's talk process a little more here. Is it like I've got a marshmallow on a stick and I'm waving my pudgy pie iron over the fire, or do I set it down near the fire? What do I do there?
Yeah, it kind of depends on how cooked you like your pudgy pie. I prefer to take my iron. And one thing I should say, if you're looking for an iron, I've seen longer ones and shorter ones. When you go look at the store for one, get a longer one so you're not burning your hand when you're sticking it into the fire.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, put it into the fire and, you know, lay it maybe like close to a flame or on a log or something that's by coals. I mean, that way you don't burn your bread right away and everything cooks a little bit more even. I mean, you could stick it right in the fire if you do like, you know, the charred bread, but I mean, I like the slow cook, you know, and just, you know, flip it over every couple of minutes or so and just check it. You know, it's real easy to unclasp the thing and look. And yeah, it all kind of just depends on your personal taste.
Wait, you've got to, so you've had this hot metal thing there. Is there like a a button at this end or a pull that I open it up with? I don't have to touch the hot.
You don't have to touch the hot iron. So on the handle, it's a wooden handle, and there's a little clasp that kind of fastens it.
Right.
So you kind of undo the clasp and then just open it up with the handles, and then you can see what's going on inside. So yeah, you don't have to, you know, touch the scalding hot metal on the end of your Pudgy Pie iron.
This keeps getting better.
I'm telling you, man.
I don't have to scald myself. All right, I think I'm finally forming the picture of how this works. Let's get into some fillings. You said breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What would I put in my breakfast version of the Pudgy Pie?
Well, you know, a great thing that you can do is you can sort of make an omelet sandwich, if you will. So I think, you know, you can go out, you know, this might be something that you might not be able to find at the grocery store, but at a camping store, you can kind of find like pre-cooked scrambled eggs, which I've actually had. You know, my first thought was, ooh, pre-cooked scrambled eggs. I don't know about that. They're actually pretty good. Throw some of that in there. Put, you know, maybe some bacon in there, whatever toppings that you would throw into an omelet. So maybe, you know, chop up some mushrooms or something, some green peppers. You know, maybe you want, you know, bacon bits or little chunks of ham or something, and just throw it in there and toast it. And all of a sudden, you've got a pretty easy breakfast. And, you know, this is something if you're camping with a family, too. I mean, it's going to make everyone in your family happy. Mm-hmm. If you've got kids, they're going to love this.
Oh, and you can mix and match what different people want and the different pies. Oh, some summer sausage, I think, would be great on that omelet sandwich.
Yeah, that sounds good, too. You know, bring some spices, bring some salt and pepper if you want. You know, do whatever you want to spice it up. It's going to taste good.
Okay, so for the rest of the meals of the day, what's your favorite? What's your favorite Pudgy Pie, Chris?
I am a pizza Pudgy Pie kind of guy, and this is another really easy thing that you can do. Just bring some cheese with you, some shredded mozzarella cheese. Bring some pizza sauce. So, you know, you'll butter the one slice of the... Well, both slices, you'll butter the bread and you'll put it into the iron so it doesn't, you know, stick in there. And then on the other side, you'll put the pizza sauce, you know, throw some cheese on it, maybe some pepperoni if you want, maybe some sausage. And again, you know, whatever you want on your pizza, like, you know, whatever you want to put in your omelet, just put it on there and go to town. And it is just a great tasting sandwich.
Yeah, and all of that you don't need to refrigerate in advance.
Yeah, I think so. You know,
or in a cooler,
yeah,
you'd be okay.
You know, the cheese, you can probably go a day or two without being refrigerated. And the thing is, you know, it's camping. It's, you know, these sandwiches aren't going to be anything fancy, but, you know, that's why you go camping, though. You kind of want to get away from it all.
Is this a long-time memory of yours, or are you a recent Pudgy Pie convert?
Yeah, I remember doing this when I was a kid.
Okay.
I was also, I was in Boy Scouts, and I think that's when I first learned about this. So, you know, growing up, it was just kind of like something we did when we went camping, which, again, you know, kind of like goes to my mortification when I heard that people on staff didn't know this was. And I don't know if this is just a Midwest thing or if this is all over the place. I mean, you're a Midwestern guy too, Rob. You're from Michigan.
But I'm not a camping guy. I never have been. Sorry.
Okay.
I like camping with roof and shower.
Well, if you've got
a
fire pit in the backyard, you know, we can try it out.
Could do it over the grill.
I think I just invited myself over.
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't have a fire pit. But I could do it over the grill, though.
You could do it over the grill, I would imagine. I've never tried that, but yeah, as long as you've got the hot coals, I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the fire. Yeah, I would imagine that would work out just fine.
Okay, tempt us with some other delightful Pudgy Pie fillings.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of searching around online in preparation of this segment, and there are more Pudgy Pie blogs than I ever thought like would have existed on the internet. And I mean, it can be as simple as I saw someone, they took a can of like Chef Boyardee spaghetti, you know, that canned spaghetti, and they put that within the bread and they made a little spaghetti sandwich. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that at home you might be like, but camping,
like,
oh man, that sounds awesome. I really want to try that.
And you had a taco one, I think, on your list.
Yeah, this is one that might take a little bit of legwork beforehand. This is something that you might need to cook the meat ahead of time. And this is, you know, another thing that you can do, too. So, you know, while you're, you know, before you go on your camping trip, when you still have access to, you know, a home kitchen or a commercial kitchen or whatever, you know, cook some meat up ahead of time and just throw it in a Tupperware container and bring it with you. So, you know, just cook up some taco meats and then bring with you, you know, a little bit of cheese. Maybe you have that left over if you're making pizza ones. You know, bring some sour cream if you want. Bring some extra taco sauce, a little bit of veggies, and just, yeah, make a taco Pudgy Pie.
One thing we haven't gotten to yet, Chris, the dessert.
Yeah, you know, you can kind of make Pudgy Pie s'mores, if you will. One thing I've seen is that, you know, instead of using like pizza sauce or whatever, just put peanut butter on there and then throw, you know, maybe half of a chocolate bar in there. If you want to put a marshmallow in there too, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I've never tried that myself, but, you know, that sounds great. And a lot of times too, you know, this could be a great way to complement, you know, when you make s'mores, you always end up with like one too many of something. You're never going to use all of the stuff. So you have like leftover graham crackers or leftover marshmallows, but not chocolate or whatever. So just throw whatever you have left over, you know, into the iron and make a dessert Pudgy Pie.
Okay, and for a non-chocolate dessert maybe in our last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, if you're craving something fruity, what you can do is just take some pie filling, actually. You know, get some cherry pie filling or some apple pie filling, and that's all you need. You know, maybe you want to bring a little bit of whipped cream with you to top it off. But yeah, just, you know, scoop a little in there, and boom, you've got yourself a quick and easy desserts.
A lot of great ideas for 4th of July weekend. Campers out there, hope you still have time to stop at the store. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
All right, now get back to work. Hey, do you want to post a thing on Facebook? Maybe people can share their pudgy pie favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get something up there, and I hope to hear from you with your recipes.
That's on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your favorite pudgy pie. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Independence Day, as you might have noticed, and our next guest says it's a good time to mark the history of giving in the U.S. She says philanthropy is closely intertwined with American history, and today's a good day to reflect on that history and make plans on giving back to the world in the future. Lisa Dietlin joins us now. She's a philanthropy expert and president and CEO of Lisa M. Dietlin & Associates. Her new book, by the way, is The Power of Three, How to Achieve Your Goals by Simply Doing Three Things a Day. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Happy 4th of July. Glad to be back.
And to you as well. Well, you call Independence Day the nonprofit sector's birthday. Why is that?
I do. You know, it occurred to me probably a couple of years ago when I was thinking about this holiday and my love of this holiday that, you know, on this day, our founding fathers, with much encouragement from our founding mothers, signed that Declaration of Independence disavowing allegiance to King George, the King of England. And at that time, a king or a queen, a monarch, as well as a state religion, provided all the resources needed for their people. What they did is they made sure there was money, Rob, for the orphanages and the libraries and the museums and the schools and the hospitals and the workhouses and the poorhouses, and they made sure that people were taken care of. Now, it might not have been the best way, you know, and the best care, but they made sure that those resources were there. So when those founding fathers signed that Declaration of Independence saying, we're not going to be part of England anymore, they actually formed the nonprofit sector. So I think it's our birthday. Happy birthday to the nonprofit sector.
And does nonprofit, does independent giving to those kinds of things you're talking about go back that far in American history?
It does. You know, many people ask that question, and there's a couple examples. One is, you know, when the Mayflower landed here, there was no, you know, school or hospital for them to go to if they needed, wanted to educate their children or they had a wound or an injury. And if they wanted that in their community, as well as a church or any other sort of library or social good, they had to build it themselves, and they had to take up collections or neighbor helping neighbor. And you know, when you think about the movie era of the 1950s depicting the great western migration of this country, you would see barn dances along with barn raisings and quilting bees and harvests. And, you know, America is rich. We're considered the most generous people in the world, and it's about neighbor helping neighbor. You know, we always step up when there's something to be done, and it's in our DNA from the time we set foot on the shores and realized we're in this, you know, for better or worse, and let's make it better.
So fast-forwarding to the modern day, how important is our nonprofit sector?
Our nonprofit sector is huge. What most people don't realize, Rob, is that 12 million people work in this sector. That's 10% of the workforce. It's the third largest employment sector after retail and manufacturing. More people actually work in the nonprofit sector than work in the automotive industry or that work in the oil and gas industry or that work in the electronics industry. We are about 5.5% of the GDP. We contribute about $335 billion a year. You know, 65 million of us volunteer every year, and nobody grows up and says, hey, Mom and Dad, I'm going to work for a charity when I get older.
So how much time do we tend to donate here in the United States?
We donate a lot of time. Americans, about 25% of our population volunteer annually, and they give about 8 billion, that's with a B, Rob, about 8 billion hours to charity, which is valued at almost $200 billion, the amount of hours that we donate. And we do everything. It's from lawyers at a legal aid clinic volunteering their time. whether it be for a criminal or a civil case, or we hear much about the Innocence Projects throughout this country when people have been wrongly convicted, where lawyers step up and often volunteer their time to help exonerate people, to, you know, graphic artists being willing to donate their time to design invitations, or doctors are going to where Doctors Without Borders operate. All across the spectrum, Americans use their skills, and it can be sheer, you know, brute force, too, you know, with the hurricane that's roaring up the East Coast, and thankfully it's tamed down a lot now. But those that come together to help a neighbor, you know, prepare their house or put sandbags together so rivers don't flood, those are all volunteers that are making a difference in this country.
You know, when we hear economics reporting, we do hear the automotive industry a lot, energy, technology, things like that. Does the nonprofit sector do things like donating and volunteering kind of fly under the radar?
They absolutely do. You know, it's really amazing. This summer I have a group of interns from Harvard and UMass Amherst and Northwestern University. And when I asked them this week, we met, and I said, what have you learned so far? Because they've been with me about a month. And they said, I never knew you could make a living in the nonprofit sector. I never knew it was this big. And so, you know, here we have very smart students that want to give back, that are volunteering their time to help learn about the nonprofit sector. And they're saying, gosh, I didn't know that this whole sector existed. But think about it, Rob. When you have a hospital that has a nonprofit status, a nonprofit, you know, coding from the IRS, every single position in that hospital is related to a nonprofit. Whether you're the security person, the parking lot attendant, the person who's the head of IT or works in the IT department or accounting or the pharmacy or the janitorial staff or the cooking people in the kitchen that prepare the food for the patients that are in the beds during these holiday times and regular season, they are all working for a nonprofit organization. So it absolutely does fly under the radar. I think part of the reason it does is because we're not singly focused. You know, automotive is automotive. Oil and gas is oil and gas. We do arts. We do animals. You know, we do environment. We're involved in every part of a human being's life, from, you know, animals to A to Z, as they say, animals to zoology. And both of those I know are animals, but the point being, we're involved in all aspects of society.
Well, let's look for some inspiration on the birthday of the nonprofit sector for maybe ways for people to get involved in donating and volunteering. A lot of veterans will be out participating in 4th of July parades today. And I know you are looking at today as a good time to think about what people can do when it comes to veterans.
Absolutely. You know, the veterans, obviously in the VA, have been in the news a lot and for a lot of negative reasons, but we still have military personnel that either are returning home or that are here and in need of our services. And there's many ways to get involved. Obviously, most parades have probably already taken place, but some communities might have activities this weekend. So one of the easiest things to do is go out and participate in your community events that are honoring veterans, where there might be gatherings and memorials taking place, and thank them. Thank them for their service. Many times in many communities have VFWs, DAVs, or American Legions. And again, many veterans gather there. You could stop by, see if an activity is taking place, or simply sit and talk to those individuals that are in that establishment and ask them to tell you their story. Ask them to tell you what they went through or what America means to them, and take your children with you. This is an excellent opportunity for the next generation to learn about what our veterans have done, what people have done who've given and who have served for this country. But if you can't do that, you know, write a letter. We still have men and women serving, that many of which don't get packages and letters. And there's a wonderful organization called AnySoldier.com. And you can write a letter, mail it to AnySoldier.com, you know, look the address up, mail it there, and they will make sure it gets to a military personnel person. So you could obviously thank them today, and they would get it in a couple of weeks, the letter. We also have the Wounded Warriors Project. You know, many of our veterans are returning, and because the advancements in technology and the way we fight wars and the way we're able to treat people after, there's more survivors, but there's more people coming back with injuries, losing a limb, losing their eyesight. And there's Wounded Warrior Project standing by them saying, we're going to provide the resources that these individuals need because they've made the sacrifice. We also have Operation Homefront for families who are here while their loved one is serving, and they do amazing work too. All great organizations, as well as the USO, who's still entertaining. Bob Hope may not be here, but we have many, you know, entertainers and artists who give up their time to go and entertain our troops, and they are always looking for donations and support.
So you've mentioned a bunch of organizations there. Even if people don't get out and do the volunteering or make the contact this weekend, this might be a good weekend to get out there and search around for a group to get involved with, veterans or otherwise. And maybe, is there such a thing as making a philanthropy and volunteering plan?
Absolutely. I always recommend that. And I love that idea, Rob, that here on the 4th of July, let's make a plan of action for the rest of the year, the next 6 months. You know, we tend to only think about charity or philanthropy around the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas primarily, or we tend to think about it as part of our New Year's resolution. I'm going to volunteer every month. I'm going to give back. I'm going to do better this year. But actually today, many families are gathered together. Many families and friends are gathered together. And why not start making your plan of action for the next 6 months of how you're going to give back? And again, you can go and do something. You can write a letter. You can make a charitable donation. You can commit to volunteer on a regular basis. Any one of those will truly make a difference in your community and throughout society.
We're talking to philanthropy expert Lisa Dietlin about giving, volunteering, philanthropy in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made a commitment to make donations of your time, money, or talent lately? Where do you make your donations? Where do you volunteer and why? Or have you been thinking about taking a step to doing something like this, but maybe need some encouragement from Lisa or some advice? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about philanthropy and the American past, present, and future. Our guest is philanthropy expert Lisa Dietlin. You can join the conversation. Tell us who you donate your time or money to and why you do it. Or if you want to give a thank you to donors or volunteers who made a difference for you in your life or maybe for your organization, give them a shout out, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org. Lisa, just a few moments ago, you mentioned families are together. This is a good time to make plans. Talk about the idea of getting the family together to decide who to make donations to or maybe even going out and volunteering as a family.
You know, it's a wonderful holiday, the 4th of July, and of course this year it falls on a Friday, so many families are coming together for an extended weekend. And I think, you know, having a conversation around giving back and where are we going to direct our donations this year and or our time as a family is perfectly appropriate as we remember, you know, the meaning of this day, that we were disavowing allegiance to a king and saying we're going to do it on our own, and we're still doing that 238 years later. So one of my ideas is as you're sitting around tonight over the barbecue or over the weekend hanging out with family and friends, talk about what you care about. Talk about what's important. Have that healthy discussion. Maybe even take up a collection first. You know, everybody put some money in the pot and take up a collection and say, okay, who are we going to donate this to? And what are we going to say about why we're donating it? And have that discussion about why it's important to give back. And it doesn't matter the sum of money, and it's the importance of having that healthy discussion and looking ahead to the fall so that when the holidays come, you have a plan, too, for giving back in your community.
And how do you cultivate the idea of giving and volunteering for kids in particular?
Well, that's a great question, and kids are so impressionable. You know, they do what their parents do, and I often see billboards saying, you know, exercise, you know, your children are looking, or eat healthy, your children are looking, while also giving back, you know, your children are looking. And I think there's a couple things you can do. One is you could give your children an allowance or a certain amount of money and say that they have to give it away, and they have to tell the family the story of what they're going to do. And perhaps today is the day. Maybe each child gets $20, $50, $100, and they're told that when the family comes back together at Christmas, they have to share what they did with that money. And the only thing is they can't spend it on themselves, and they can't keep it, meaning they have to help someone else. And that's the only direction to give them. I've heard of a couple that they're friends of mine, and they do this with their grandsons. And they started when they were 5 and 7, Rob. And they gave them, you know, like $3, $5 bills. And they said, you can't spend it on yourself or anyone in the family, but and you can't keep it, but you have to give it and you have to, you know, tell us why and who you gave it to and why you chose to do that. And the boys were so excited, and they made their donations, and they came back and they told the grandparents. And the next year they asked the grandparents, are we going to do it again?
Oh.
So they were learning already, Rob. They were learning. And this young generation, the millennials, are so committed to giving back. We see it all the time with, you know, their social media posts and their what they care about and what they think is important. It's not about to them how, the title or the job that they get. For a lot of them, it's about, are they making a difference in a world that they grew up in that was post 9/11, where people went to work one day and didn't come home because other people flew planes into buildings. And they grew up in that world, and they say, you know what, there's more important things than having a really big bank account or driving the most fancy car that I can possibly think of. They want to make a difference in other people's lives.
So supposing we don't have a ton of money to make a difference, how do we find an organization, an effort that's a good match for us that we can kind of make a difference for?
There's a couple websites I recommend going to. One is volunteermatch.org. Volunteermatch.org, it's based out of San Francisco, but it works nationally, and it lists organizations that are looking for volunteers, both those that are kid-friendly and those that are for adults only. That's an excellent place to start. Another one is womenoncall.org. It's another national organization started by a friend of mine, and she started it because women oftentimes don't have blocks of time to give, but they have an hour to give, or they might have an hour a night to give to work on a project. So both nonprofit organizations list projects that they need help on, as well as individuals. Women can go on and say, I would like to donate. I'm a lawyer. I'd be willing to review contracts or write a contract, or I'm a graphic artist. And they actually help, and they do that match. So those are great organizations to go to for information. But one of the best ones is in your own hometown. If you have a community foundation, or if you have a house of worship you attend, you know, go to your community foundation or call them and ask, you know, what's the greatest need? Where can we volunteer? You know, especially if you want to involve your kids. Or go to your house of worship and ask, where is there a need and where can we make a difference?
You know, when it comes to giving, getting into a habit of something like exercise, a lot of times I hear advice along the lines of make it social, make it a social activity. Can the same thing be true with philanthropy, however we approach it?
Absolutely, it can be. And I think it's more fun when you do it with someone. You know, philanthropy is a great way to meet other people. You know, when you volunteer, whether you're raking senior citizens' lawns, or you know, you're painting a wall of a senior center, or you're stuffing backpacks with food for kids, there's great ways to meet other people. But it's also good to have a buddy, because if you know somebody's meeting you there, oftentimes you're more likely to show up or less likely to make an excuse that you can't go. I love the idea, you know, when we think about gifts for our parents and our siblings, saying, you know what, you have what you need, or I don't know what to buy you. Who needs another candle or another tie or what have you? But why don't we once a month volunteer? Why don't we once a month do something together so we can spend time together and we can also be making a difference in our community?
An email from Nancy in Green Bay. She writes, my husband and I are volunteer tutors for literacy in Green Bay. Oh, for the group, sorry, Literacy Green Bay. We work with an adult from Mexico, helping them learn English. We meet twice a week for an hour and a half each time. Nancy writes, we get as much from it as our students do.
I love that. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you to you and your husband. That's fabulous. And there is such a need for tutors in the literacy field. I've learned about this recently, that there is a great number of individuals in our country who are illiterate, who aren't proficient in English. So if that is something that is a passion of yours, absolutely volunteer throughout the country and follow Nancy and her husband's lead.
And Lisa, I mentioned earlier your new book is called The Power of Three, How to Achieve Your Goals by Simply Doing Three Things a Day. And I know it's about taking something that looks big and monumental, breaking it into pieces, doing a little bit at a time. How could we apply that to making ourselves philanthropists?
That is an excellent question, and I have an answer. I was just out on a walk with a friend this morning, and we were talking, and my shoe came untied. And I bent down to pick it up, tie the shoe, and there was a piece of garbage there. And I picked up the garbage. It was a wrapper that was flying around. And she looked at me quizzically, and I said, well, every day I pick up a piece of garbage. It's one of the three things I do to make a difference in my community. Huh. I said, I pick up a piece of garbage, Rob. I try to write a piece of personal correspondence to somebody, you know, thanking them for something they did or congratulating them for something they did. And the third thing I try to do is smile or acknowledge everyone, as well as pay a compliment. I learned last year while I was kayaking on this trip on the Chicago River that this man shared with me that his friend smiles or acknowledges everyone he meets because he read a research study that said the number one cited reason that people who are contemplating suicide don't commit it is because somebody acknowledged them or smiled at them. And his friend thinks when he smiles all day long or acknowledges people, when he puts his head on the pillow at night, he's most likely saved a life.
Wow.
And I thought, I'm going to do that too. So, you know, I could say, you know, make a donation every day, volunteer an hour, but really for the listeners, if you can do three things, pick up a piece of garbage and put it in the receptacle, write a piece of personal correspondence to someone, and smile or acknowledge everyone you meet, you'll be making a difference and having a huge impact in your community.
Lisa, that's amazing. And, you know, I keep using the word philanthropy kind of on purpose because when I think that word, I think of somebody handing a giant $1 million check to the Children's
yeah.
Hospital, which is great. I don't want to discourage anybody from doing that. But thinking that way can discourage us from tackling those little things.
Right. You know, philanthropy at its root means brotherly love, Rob. I mean, it's looking out for your neighbor. And that's what Independence Day was about. In Independence Day, you know, those men who signed the Declaration of Independence were looking out for each other, whether they were from Connecticut or Georgia or they were from, you know, New York. They were looking out for each other and saying, this isn't right. We're going to do better. We're going to have a better world. And it doesn't mean you have to have $1 million or $1,000 or $100 to give to someone. You can truly make a difference by simply acknowledging someone, smiling at them, telling them what a difference they made in your life, writing a piece of correspondence, picking up a piece of garbage. The list goes on and on. One of my favorites is, you know, when you're going to the post office to buy a book of stamps, buy one for your favorite nonprofit and give it to them. You know, put it in the mail, send it to them. Nonprofits need stamps. Or if you're a business owner and you're buying a box with reams of paper from Quill or Staples or, you know, whatever supply company you go to, order an extra box of copy paper and send it to your favorite nonprofit. There are so many easy ways to be a philanthropist. I would say to the listeners, do not become uncomfortable with that term. Become comfortable, embrace it, especially on the 4th of July.
Lisa, great talk as always. Thank you so much for joining us on Independence Day.
Happy 4th of July.
That's Lisa Dietland. She's a philanthropy expert. She's president and CEO of Lisa M. Dietland & Associates. Her new book is The Power of Three, How to Achieve Your Goals by Simply Doing Three Things a Day. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.